You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. Tony Duchesne here, and welcome to Drinks with Tony. Join me for my workshop called The Novel Approach. It's The Novel Approach Workshop with Tony Duchesne. Starts on April 6th. What is the novel? Writing the novel is an esoteric task. It's not complicated, but it's not easy. So I'm going to be your guide through the process. Writing a novel is also balm for the soul. When I finished my last novel, I realized that my novel already gave me everything I needed, and it's not even to a publisher yet. It's being shopped, but it's already given me all the benefits of writing the novel. And you know how when you connect with a novel and it really like touches your soul? Well, flip it to the other side when you're the author and you're connecting with your characters and building and working with your characters intimately for years. So my soul is touched probably more than any of the readers. And that's the beauty of writing a novel. So we're going to talk about craft of novel, and we're also going to really dive into the creativity of the novel. Drinkswithtony.com. Go to drinkswithtony.com for the link to sign up for the Novel Approach Workshop with Tony Duchesne. And now, on with the show.
Hi, I'm Darryl Santola, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Darryl Santola. She's the author of Finding Truth with Michael, a memoir of friendship, faith, and first love. Darryl, how are you?
Hi, Tony. It's good to see you. I'm well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm well. It's good to see you, too. I know we've talked before the taping, but we have to get that one question out of the way for the listeners. You know, they need to know where we're at emotionally.
That's right.
I'm so glad you're on the show. So some of you may know that I grew up a Jehovah's Witness, and I also wrote a book about it. And guess what? Darryl's grew up a Jehovah's Witness, but with the Jackson family, and we're talking about Michael Jackson, LaToya, and around that. And that's what your memoir is about, which is, I'm going to gush on you for like 1 second. I'm very sorry.
Okay.
But I love a greatly written ex-Jehovah's Witness book, because 80% of ex-Jehovah's Witness books really suck. So I'm very happy that you're representing us well, my sister.
Okay. I appreciate that compliment, and I will receive it.
I feel like we're in a therapy session. Now, I'm going to give you the bear, and you just tell me what okay. you feel.
Well, you know, that did not come easy, that writing a book that you consider well-written. And yeah. We'll likely get into that process.
Well, a book that, I mean, from my experience, when people say, oh, writing Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk must have been very therapeutic. And I was like, no. It was the opposite. I was in therapy twice a week so I can get through writing that. That was not a therapeutic process. That was an urgency from my soul to forgive myself for feeling bad for growing up a Jehovah's Witness and for being ashamed of it. And I really needed and when I say the world, not in the Jehovah's Witness term, but the world, like the other people of Earth, to just know that I needed to yell from the mountain that, hey, this is my identity, and I've forgiven myself for having this identity that I didn't even realize that I had not forgiven myself for. And I don't know if you had similar, or what was your experience like when you're trying to put this together, as well as trying to craft a memoir at the same time, which is two different things, yet we create magic when we do this.
I relate to what you say about working through the shame of having had that identity, because I'm sure as you conveyed your story and your narrative throughout the different chapters of your life, the reaction that you got was so different, and how you felt about the reaction likely was very different depending on what age you were and how much self-empowerment you have at the time. But I used to be very ashamed of having been a Jehovah's Witness, but mostly I was confused by having been a Jehovah's Witness because I wasn't raised one. I wasn't born into it. I chose to be a Jehovah's Witness as an adolescent. And so I think that part was very confounding to me as I found my way out of it and unraveled the mind control, looking at what allowed it or the source of it was also part of my discovery in the writing.
That is fascinating. So, was there an emotion where you had to forgive yourself for joining in a way? Because I didn't, because I wasn't born into it, but my parents were baptized by the time I was 3 years old. So I is essentially born into it, and I had no choice, and I had
Yes.
no other context or reference point for to be a young teenager and have context or a reference point and then choose it. Is that hard to go back and go, wait, what was I thinking? Or how do is there that is that the pro part of the process?
Well, yes, what was I thinking and what were the circumstances? What was the entire setting that allowed that? Not only my childhood, because as a mental health clinician, I poke around in people's childhoods. So it was my opportunity to poke around in my own and really look at what environment would have allowed a 12, 13-year-old to be indoctrinated like that. So that was really also part of my process, was that excavation of the what happened and what made me the way I am.
And when you're doing that excavation, at what point do you say, you know what, I'm working on myself, but I feel like this also needs to be written. This also needs to be out there for the public. Like, at what point do you realize that it's just like, wait a second, I'm working on myself, but I also realize that this actually is a story that. That's I feel like good ex-Jehovah's Witness stories need to be out there. And so it's almost, and even when I wrote Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk, there had been some books that had come out that were by ex-Jehovah's Witnesses that were atrociously written. And I was like, and there was an anger in me going, no, we need a good rep. And that is so I was trying, I was. That's why when we were talking earlier, I wasn't writing that for ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. I was writing that to be in the literary community as a novelist. Like that was the entire, that was number one. Number two was my identity, but that was for me just writing it because I writing it was hitting the shadow, doing like hurting. And but it's like I had to go through that void and awfulness to get to the other side of it. And then it still hurt, but it hurt. And there was a shift in the hurt, I guess. And I'm still trying to figure that out. I have no answers.
Well, for me, the process of writing is the significance, not necessarily the outcome, which is important, right? That's what we're
Yes.
giving people. That's important for others. But for me, the importance was the process of making truth of my truth and trying to tell and show as opposed to tell, or really reveal as opposed to explain. So it's kind of like you have this huge block of clay, and the story is really in what you take away from the clay, the editing.
You are speaking my language, sister. Like it's just that you have. I was working on an essay today. How my not I have a current novel that I'm querying that has nothing to do with religion. That's just a that's a fictional novel. But I've gone through a lot of grief over the last 5 years, and the 4 years that I wrote that novel, the novel has already done all the work in my life it needs to do. That writing that novel, which
Mm-hmm.
was playful but also tackled a couple of themes that are ongoing in my life, but it's a humor, it's a comedy. But that was the balm to my soul when things were going really bad in my life. I could look at my novel, my characters, and go, "I'm coming back for you, Sebastian. I'm coming back for you, Carissa." It was almost like having the best wife on earth and giving her the kiss every day before I went back out, but went back into the big bad world of what my life was. And then knowing that she's waiting at home for me, except she's on pages. And it's pro and as you may have found out, when we write, whether it's our memoirs or our novels, we're working on characters. We're working on, either true life characters or, and when we put that much work into it, the intimate relationship is more intimate than some of our friendships and even some of our truly intimate relationships when we're working with characters, with people and putting it on the written page. And we're doing that 4 hours a day. That means we're having heavy sessions with these characters.
Yeah, it's very relational.
Yeah. And then it, but it's, it, and it just, it
Yeah.
does, it's been blowing my mind as I just query out here and there. But there's part of me with this novel that I'm just like, you've already done so much for me. I almost want to keep you for myself, but I know I can't. I don't know if you had ever had those thoughts.
Well, I did have that thought many times. After having written the book, so maybe I put it on the shelf because I've done this. And it wouldn't stay on the shelf. That is the problem with the book. It just had a life of its own and it kept jumping off the shelf, needing to be told, which is where I am now, telling it.
And how are you feeling now that it's out there? Because that's I know the feeling of that, so I want to know your feeling of that. Because I mean, we all have our different feelings, but what's it like now that your story is out there? And you and I are doing a book soup event in about a week and a half too. So it's here it comes. Here
Right.
comes the
There
spotlight.
is,
How does that feel?
it feels terrifying and at the same time exhilarating. And what I do know from a neuroscience point of view, that those two states live in the same place in the brain. So excitement and fear, and they're intermingled, and I'm feeling both of them. But the fear of being seen and visible is kind of terrifying. And at the same time, not having a voice is also terrifying. So it's about that conflict and the resolution of the conflict, which is allowing oneself to be seen, even though it's terrifying.
Especially when it's terrifying. I talk to my students, and usually when they say, "Oh, I'm too scared to write that," I'm like, "That's what you're gonna have to write." And if you say the words, "I'm too scared to write that," that's what you have to work on. And it's not fun, but those are the greatest books. Like when I talked to authors and they said, "I was so scared to write this." And I'm just like, "Yeah, I could tell because it's great." I could tell it's great because you went into the vulnerable and we're all vulnerable. And that's the beauty of it. Like people. We all have the human condition. I remember, not to go on, but we both wrote ex-Jehovah's Witness books, and people coming up to me telling me, "You wrote my story, and I could never have told anybody that." Not even just ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. I got letters from Southern Baptists. I was going,
Sure.
and
I
I was like,
control religions.
"Yeah," and it was just like, "Thank you for telling my stories." I didn't even know my story, like in a way, until I read the book. And it's just like, whoa. And it's not what I set out to do. I just wanted to get the Man Booker Prize and become a big time famous novelist. That didn't happen. So I became a mediocre selling novelist. But yeah.
Didn't happen yet.
Didn't happen yet. I actually am really excited about Dreamcasting because this is the first time I felt the urgency that Jesus Jerk gave me years ago, and I've written a few books in between that didn't have that urgency. This one has the urgency. It's this, and it when you're when that, and I listen to my gut. I've learned to listen to it as a writer, and to write from my gut, and to not know what the hell I'm doing. The minute even if I've worked on something for 2 years, I'm like, I don't know how to fix that. I don't know what the next scene is. I don't. But I go to it going, hey, I don't know. But as I write, it'll work itself out. And it's just so mind-blowing that that's another fear spot, going into that blank page and it's staring at you, just start writing. And that's the game. And I've talked to writers who
Sure,
have
it's the
like,
doing.
yeah, there's one writer, he's got like 25 books on the New York Times published bestseller list. And I was like, what do you do with the next one? You got to feel like it's got to feel different than the first one. He's like, yes, it feels worse because now I'm going to let myself and everybody down if this is not a bestseller. But I always know that that's the same feeling I have every single time. And that feeling's never going to go away. So just work for the through the awful uncomfortable of it to get to the next moment.
I have to say that my goal for this book was never to be a bestseller, because and I don't think that this is the kind of book that would hit that sort of mark. But I did write this book for the experience of what you had, and that somebody coming up to me and saying, "You told my story, and it helped me."
Yeah.
That's what I'm hoping for.
And it's what you'll get over and over again. I already know. I'm so excited. I'm so excited when we talk again in a few months after a lot of people have read the book and you go, oh, Tony, we gotta talk. We gotta have coffee because I gotta tell you what happens. And I'm just like, oh yeah, I can't wait to hear that part. But this is also a story of
I can't wait to tell you that.
I know. And it'll be soon. And well, it'll be joyous. But you are also close to not only close to the Jackson family, but you and Michael Jackson actually studied essentially, and I say this to the general audience so they know. I would say it, you studied the Watchtower together. To the Jehovah's Witness audience, I would say you were a Bible study together, which
That's right.
they know the level of that, where that doesn't translate to people who've never been Jehovah's Witnesses, which is okay because work, translation's translation, so.
Well, there definitely is a hierarchy in the Bible study paradigm of Jehovah's Witnesses. And as you know, you turn in your hours of service and how many magazines or books you've placed and how many hours of service. And so my time with Michael Jackson was, I was his mentor in Jehovah's Witnesses, and he was my mentee. So I taught him the Bible and turned in those hours.
Which is pretty saucy, in the Jehovah where I grew up in the Jehovah's Witnesses, because if a woman is studying with a man, when I grew up, they would always try to find a brother to go study with the man. The woman can start it, but a brother has to finish it. So, I believe you may have gone through this in the book, but how did you pull it off that you were studying with Michael Jackson, the King of Pop, by the way? And I want to ask you some questions about that. But anyway, how did it come up that you were able to do this?
Well, we went to
From
the
the
same high school.
theocratic from the theocratic
Oh,
order.
from the the person I studied the Bible with, when I called her and told her that Michael Jackson asked me to study the Bible with him, she said, "Oh, you're not supposed to because of the gender requirement." And then she called one of the elders, and they said that they would make an exception because we were in high school together, and likely that was going to allow the study to happen as opposed to bringing someone else in.
And the other
So
thing
they
was
made
my,
an exception.
yes. And at the same time, Michael Jackson also had a tour schedule. He had TV appearances to do. So you were kind, that's why you would have an exception. And I can see why you would have that exception, because the Jehovah's Witnesses would make that exception, especially for someone who's and I say a bright star. When I say a bright star, I mean Michael Jackson had light. Like he was like almost as pe when people just have a light, and he had, it seemed like at that time he had that joy and that light and that beauty that was,
Stardust.
yeah.
Yeah,
And it,
he did have that light.
I, you know, following him as a fan and also as someone knowing that he grew up a Jehovah's Witness and knowing the struggles he went through. And knowing, if I remember right, please correct me if I'm wrong, that his Pepsi can was actually fine wine, where he was in those days when he was drinking his soda, it was, they were shifting it out for him. I don't know if you knew that or if you.
Oh, I didn't know that. No.
Oh yeah, so
And that was past our time.
way past,
So,
and I felt
right.
my soul hurt for him, and I felt bad for him because I kind of had this feeling that he never fully got out of the Jehovah's Witnesses. He still felt bad, and he was acting out. And I was just like, I just wished I could have. I wished, even before he died, I was like, man, I wish I could have a conversation with him, like, and before I had anything out, and there would be no reason for him to have a conversation with me, but there was always just like, I wish I can connect with him on just an ex Jehovah's Witness level and kind of just talk it out, because I think he's being so insulated by being a pop star that it's messing with the release of the pain that he's probably feeling.
Yeah,
Or I'm
that
reading
sounds
way
like
too into
likely.
it. Yeah.
Well, but no, I think as an ex-Jehovah's Witness, you know what it takes to really deconstruct all of that. And it takes a lot. And likely, I mean, we can only assume that he didn't have the space for all of that.
Yeah. The like I'm looking at the cover photo right now, and it's just so good of you and Michael Jackson.
Those are
And
our high school yearbook pictures, Tony.
oh, it's so great. It's so of that time too. It's so beautiful. It's such a unique story that you have, because you were, I mean, for you to be doing a Bible study at high school, I feel like that is a commitment of next level of a teenage Jehovah's Witness. Because me as a teenage Jehovah's Witness didn't want anyone to know, but I believed 100%. And I also believed that at the time the Watchtower Society said, well, if someone's ignorant of being our teachings, Jehovah will let them through Armageddon, and then we can study with them and see if they want to stay in the new system. And that caveat in my head was like, oh my God, I want all of my friends in high school to be ignorant, because I don't want them to have the life that I have right now, because I knew that my life was not a, I was living a monk's life because I knew the truth. I did never disregarded it. I was like, oh, I have to live this stoic monk's life to because I know, and I don't want my friends to know, because I don't want them to be part of the hurt that I'm feeling now. And also at the same time, I didn't want to be singled out as a teenager. I just wanted to be a normal teenager. So I wanted that normalcy. And it's so for you to study with Michael Jackson in a high school setting is an act of bravery of faith, I think. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, well, because I became a Jehovah's Witness and wasn't raised a Jehovah's Witness, I had a lot of pride about that. And so being seen as one for me and being different than the other kids at school, even though it was uncomfortable, it was kind of an identity that I liked. And Michael Jackson, he had affiliation with Jehovah's Witnesses because his
Right.
mother studied and his older sister lived in another state and she was a devout Jehovah's Witness. So both of us were really wanting it, which is very different than most teenagers. We were wanting to find God and find answers and order, and I think very different than your experience. So
Oh,
we
that
were
is,
seeking it out.
yeah. And from what I understand about Michael's family at that time with the father, when his abusive stuff that he was doing with those poor kids, from what I remember, like bringing them to strip clubs and stuff like that, while mom was trying to, when they were young. I don't know if you remember
Yeah,
that ever.
that again, that didn't really come up in
Yeah.
our conversations because that was before. I think that's
Yeah.
when he was really little.
But to have that searching for something that's different than that, because that's way
Yes.
too much. I think it's too much trauma to put on a kid to put them in that type of situation. So
Right.
to have to go, wait a second, if I just look at this Bible and believe and know that everything's going to be taken care of and I'll live on paradise earth, that's a beautiful gift.
It is. It's just so cut and dry and simple, and it explains everything and it tells you what to do and what to think, and you live forever in paradise. It's great, great deal.
Isn't it? Yeah. I
Eternally.
eternally, I know,
You live,
till
yeah,
it's
in paradise.
yeah. Who wouldn't want
But
that?
first, you have to see everyone who isn't a Jehovah's Witness die a violent death first, before that can happen.
Yeah. I was married to a Jehovah's Witness. I was still a Jehovah's Witness in my 30s and 20s and 30s. And I was married, and I told her at some point, I was like, I just can't go anymore. Like, there's something wrong. I don't know what it is, but I know that I'll be forgiven if I just stop going right now, because I can't. And that's when I really started diving into writing and just being an artist. I forgot where I was going on that. What we were just talking about. Anyway, maybe that'll come back. Geriatric dementia 101 here on Drinks with Tony. And so what was it? I mean, you're doing something that's pretty intimate with Michael Jackson, which is really it, which is seeking a higher spiritual being, whether it's with the Jehovah's Witnesses or Buddhism or something else. There's a bonding that happens there. Was there a bonding that happened between you and Michael?
Yes, very much so, because of this idea that we had the truth, that we had this golden ticket to paradise, was very bonding. And we were also really connected over wanting to get our family members who weren't Jehovah's Witnesses converted, because we wanted them to live in paradise with us forever. So that was really one of our big dilemmas, was what are we going to do about the non-believers?
Yeah. I was a pioneer and still lived at home when I was like 18 or 19. And my dad had left, my sister never got baptized, and my mom had left, and I was still going to the Kingdom Hall. I still fully believed. And things were really bad at home, but the elders kept telling me, Tony, you need to stay there because they'll learn by your example and they'll come back. They'll learn it. So there was about 2 years of me just staying at a really bad situation at home so I could get my parents and my sister into the Jehovah's Witnesses, which is back in the Jehovah's Witnesses, which is all I wanted to do. Like that's like that was my entire goal between 18 and 20. And then things came up and things shattered here, and it was just a little crack open, a crack opening. That sounds druggy. It was a crack. It was just a small crack of light. And I was like, oh, I can't look at that light yet. No. But the cracks took about a decade. And that's the fiction of my novel, because I compressed a decade, which is really boring, to a year, which is a little more fun. And that's what, so people think I got out really fast. I'm like, no, I stayed a virgin until I was 25 and I was married. It's just like, it's some of that stuff in there didn't happen, but it was the, let's
Right.
let, but most of that stuff did happen, and it happened in different ways. So anyway. But yeah,
Right.
so what was so I was reading a chapter this morning about when your faith was broken. What was the first crack in your faith? What was the what because you were in for the long haul. This is truth. And then what was the, oh wait, the first moment of doubt?
There were a couple things that happened. 1975 was the date that Armageddon was destined to occur, and it was documented and written in all of the Jehovah's Witness literature, which, by the way, now that's all been erased.
Yeah.
But when 1975 came and then passed, and it was 1976, that was a real head scratcher. But during that year, my sister, who was also, she was sort of the one who led the way. We were recruited together for these people that we babysat for. And my sister left the religion and she became a model and she became a Playboy model. And so she didn't actually officially leave, but she just stopped going. And then I was questioned and interrogated quite a bit about her. And that was the second crack. Was when I was asked to not only monitor my sister, but then report on her and tell on her. And we shared a bedroom, and it just did not, I wasn't supposed to speak to her. She was disfellowshipped. So all of that was really difficult. And so I think that those two things began my ability to maybe question. And then what happened with that, Tony, is I became more devout. Every time there was a crack, that is when I threw myself in even further. I have to study more hours. Michael and I are going to get on the phone more and talk about these things. And, we would go to lunch and I would report those hours because we would talk about an article from The Awake or Watchtower magazine. So I threw myself in with each doubt. And then I graduated high school at 15. And I turned 16 that summer. And so I didn't have a choice about not going to college, as Jehovah's Witnesses do not pursue higher education. But because I was a minor and I was so young, I had to go to college. And Jehovah's Witnesses couldn't really say much about it because I had to do what my parents told me to do. And so when I started college, I took a few classes that mentioned religious studies. And I thought that's a really interesting subject. I didn't even know that you could major in such a thing. So I started going to the library and pulling out religious studies books and filling my mind with all kinds of information that I had not had before. And I started asking questions. And that was really the beginning of the end.
How did you feel when you first started with that first religious study, like the first book that you're like, hey, wait a second, I could read about outside religions? Did you feel a twinge of guilt by doing that outside of the Jehovah's Witness information highway of, keep your blinders on, brothers and sisters?
Not only did I feel guilt, but I told on myself because I felt like I
I
had to
laugh because
share.
I laugh people because I get that. No, I don't laugh because it's a funny situation. I laugh because I understand that. Go ahead, Charles.
So then I was told not to do that,
Yeah.
and that was very confusing to me because it was four stories of books in a library. How can you be told what to read and not what not to read? So I didn't know what I was supposed to read and not read. And so I stayed in the area of religious studies and picked out books that I thought, well, maybe they wouldn't disapprove of this one, or I tried to stay with safer books. But
Oh,
either way, I kept going.
yeah. That's so fantastic, because we do, it's, I understand this on so many levels, because it's just like there's certain books you can never like read, or if I was always scared the demons were going to come after me, even after I, intellectually said something's wrong. But I, there were books I would not read. I still did. I didn't listen to Ozzy Osbourne until I was in my 30s, and I was just like, oh wait, that's it. Not that that's it, that it's bad music. It's that's it. Like, I thought they were making this to be so much worse than it is. This is great music. And they, I remember from the platform at assemblies, Ozzy Osbourne was mentioned by name. And I prayed when with Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk that they would name me, but they never did. Like this other apostate, and I never got disfellowshipped. I was never, I'm the big time confuser. They didn't know what to do with me, because I left and I was still married, and I wasn't gonna go do Rumspringa and get into, drugs. And it doesn't sound like you did that either. I
No.
was living as a husband and interested in art, and they just didn't know what to do with that, so they just left me alone. Like, what?
Yeah. Right. So they never labeled you apostate.
Until the book came, until the book, well, until I found out my Jehovah's Witness wife was cheating on me and setting up a really awful divorce. And that happened. And this is where I believe in God and the universe, because I had finished my last draft of Jesus Jerk about 3 weeks before I found out what was going on in my marriage. And then she went, and it was, Tony's a spiritual abuser and he has an apostate book he wrote. And that was the story. So then the Jehovah's Witnesses came after me, and it was like friends, like Jehovah's Witness friends who would get just trashed and drunk at my house and passed out, and would come to, like, I was able to get them to film screenings and see free bands because I was writing for San Francisco Chronicle and doing all this stuff, and they were glomming onto me. They came after me, wishing that I was like dead. Please, please don't put out that book. It's going to be so hard for us in the ministry, and all these things. And I forgot what the why we were talking about that, but the
About you being apostate,
and that's where the
or
apostasy came
yeah.
in. So he has an apostate book, but no, but they didn't understand that book. You can't write a book. I can't write a book out of anger. I could start from anger, and then I could start. And then I got to find the funny and go, wait a second, why does that anger me? And then if I can find that through line, I have to write it with joy and love. So I wrote Jesus Jerk with joy and love, because there's no other way to write something, even if it's painful, even if I'm tearing into tragedy. Joy and love has to be the I guess the hallmarks of my relationship with the novel.
But
Whatever
you
I'm
were
working
talking
on.
about how you said that made you believe in God because of the timing of all of that
Yes,
and how that all went
I
down.
finished my last draft of Jesus Jerk in like April 2008. About 2 weeks later, she took off to go find herself, and but I didn't know that she had already been setting me up for divorce for about a year, and had been cheating on me and all this stuff. And then all these Jehovah's Witnesses came at me. If I had tried to write that book after knowing what was happening next, I could never have written that book, because I wouldn't have been able to write it in love. So there was a denial to write that book that I needed, where it almost scares me. And it's just like, did the universe pull the brakes on my denial, or give me full speed denial to write a book in love, so I can connect it, so I can connect and like have this relationship with this story in a way that is going to not ever be able to happen again the minute everything comes crashing down. That was the synchronicity.
Right. Yeah. Well done.
Thank you. Did you find synchronicities like that as you were, as you've been working on getting this story out?
Well, when I started working on the book, one of the things that happened when I was in the midst of commitment to the book and leaving Neverland happened.
Yeah.
That documentary about Michael Jackson. And so at that point, I thought, well, I'm going to write this book, but absolutely no one will want to read it because what's happening with Michael Jackson's reputation. But I
Yeah.
didn't write the book about Michael Jackson. It was really about me, and he's part of my story. So
Yes.
when that happened, a lot of people said, oh, too bad you didn't get your book out before that. I got discouraged by that. But then I thought, but you know what? That really doesn't have anything to do with me, and that's not my story, so I could keep going. So that was a bit discouraging. And then, now that I have gotten to this point, I went through so many different edits, found the story ready. I went to publishers, went through a self a hybrid situation, ended up going to self-publishing, all of that. Then it turns out this movie's coming out. And then that's kind of good timing because there's a Michael Jackson biopic coming out.
Oh,
But
there
either
is.
way, I wasn't timing anything according
Yeah.
to all of that. Yes. But at the end of this month, there's a Michael Jackson biopic coming out. I didn't write the book knowing that was going to happen.
Do you know if it's going to skew towards like the good part or the bad part, or try to have a what do you call it, objective point of view? Or I don't know, because I haven't heard about
I
it. I
believe
just
it's more about, from what I know, it's about his whole career. And
Yeah.
I don't know how they handle the allegations.
Yeah.
But I know it's
The
not about that.
that's yeah.
It is about the arc of his career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Feel free to say I don't want to answer this question. But just, and that's fine. But do you want to tell me your thoughts on the allegations or no?
You know, my
Feel free
story
to
is
say no.
such a,
Feel free to
it's
say
not even,
no. Yeah.
okay. I think not. I think because that's, I don't really weigh in on that. I just have a
Yes.
whole
Okay.
different Michael Jackson in my life than that
Yes.
Michael Jackson, than the adult. We had an adolescent, sweet friendship that was so sacred
Yeah.
that doesn't touch it.
Yeah. Good answer. I feel like you're going to get that answer a lot. I mean, that question a lot, especially if you're going to actual news sources and not me, which is just a dude on a podcast. But yeah, it's I feel like it's so sad and complicated. His story. Your story's sad and complicated too, though, and it's right there that I that that elder who was had some scotch before he talked to you and started his interrogation and tried to kiss you on the lips. I'm like, yeah, that stuff goes on. That stuff goes on. And I get now remind me, was that probably the last straw where you went, wait a second, something is really wrong. I can't even get this situated in my head.
That was the last straw for me.
Yeah.
And that is when I wrote a resignation letter. Well, I had written my resignation letter. But the last straw for me was that. And then I went and read the book I was not allowed to read. And that was called I Was a Watchtower Slave, written by an ex Watchtower Society founder. One of the original guys wrote that book about the corruption of the organization. And so I knew exactly where it was on the library shelf. And I reached for it, thinking maybe my hands would. turn electric, just like the witch in Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. But I reached for that book and I devoured that book. I read the whole thing from cover to cover. And that was kind of it for me. I got all the information I needed there. And my mind was open enough at that point. I had asked enough questions that were not answered, and repeatedly my thoughtfulness in the rewording of my questions was received with the same answer every time. You have to trust God. You're not
Right.
studying hard enough. You're not devout enough. So when that answer, no matter how I framed my question, kept coming back at me, I knew that I had to rely on my own critical thinking. And I didn't even know what critical thinking was until I went to university. And even that concept blew my mind. Oh, I can think for myself, of course.
That is so fascinating. Well, I had critical thinking, the finding the book. How fortunate were you that you graduated high school early and that you had to go to college? Do you think if you graduated high school when you were 18, that you would have had a very different trajectory in your life?
Possibly, Tony.
Yeah.
That is, it's quite possible because it really is being able to work with the mind, right?
Yeah.
It's all about what you believe. I mean, you believe that demons were going to come and get you, even though you
Yeah.
didn't believe in it anymore, right?
Right.
So yes, I do think that ability for the neuroplasticity to
Yes.
occur at that young age really served me.
Have you felt any guilt in this process, even a twinge, like in the back of your mind, or when it comes out, when as this book has come out, have you had any, like, just a lingering question from deep in your subconscious go, hey, Darls, what are you doing?
You mean as far as is that the truth or not the truth? Or
As
did I lead
far,
a religion that I shouldn't have led?
is not is that the truth or is that not the truth? But that thing that we have, the thing that I have a hard time getting out of my DNA, which is still a little tap on the shoulder from the Jehovah's Witnesses, a tap that I know all too well because that's in. I know that's a part of me now, and it grows softer. The tap grows softer, but it's still there. And we'll have moments. I'll be walking on the street going, I think Confessions of a Genius, Jesus Jerk was one of the biggest mistakes I ever made in my life, and that's a thought I have. And then it's like, no, it's probably the best. I think that was the best and only way to go with what I had at that point. And what I move forward with.
Yeah. Those days of questioning are gone, but they were there for a while. They
Yeah.
lingered. But too many years have passed now, and I've done too much work on it. But there were times where I actually envied Jehovah's Witnesses who still believed it with fervor
Yes.
because
Yeah.
I didn't. And I thought, oh my, they're so safe and secure in their beliefs. They don't have the big wide open questions that I have. They have
Right.
an answer. And so there was a little bit of envy for that naivete and that innocence once it was lost.
And that's something that I mean, I teach screenwriting too, so I'm going through with my students all the time the hero's journey. And when the hero has to go through the dark night of the soul in order to get to the act three, and it's like nobody gets out for free. You get out with a price, but that price is that dark night of the soul, or that when you're completely alone and you're like, how do I get to that next thing in life and slay the dragon, this dragon that's scaring me to death? And I think that's the only way we grow, whether it's ex-Jehovah's Witnesses or other situations like that, where it's you, we go right into the fear and go, this feels so scary, but it's scarier to stay back there. It's scarier to
Precisely.
be in the be na be naive and have a smile, but that smile has an inauthenticity to it that I think the body knows, or the soul knows just enough, and the Jehovah's Witnesses know how to cover that up. To suppress
That was
that.
so well said. Exactly.
The
The
acid
body
just
does
hit.
know. I think the
Yeah.
body knows first.
Yes. Oh my God. I got to talk to you about my years of agoraphobia, my years of panic attacks. It's like when I read Crisis of Conscience,
Please.
that was kind of my first, that was when my faith broke. And I was about 33, 34 years old. 33. If I was 33, that would be quite amazing numerology wise. Me, Jesus, Chris Farley,
That was Ray Franz, right?
Ray Franz. I read that.
Was that Ray Franz?
Yes, I read that, and that shattered my soul. That shattered my belief system. I tell people, I'm like, it was like I was walking on Earth, and all of a sudden, Earth became water, and water became Earth, and I was drowning. Like that. And that's when I started getting my severe panic attacks. And that got worse and worse and worse. And but my belief system was shattered, and my body was being a beautiful messenger and telling me a lot of things that I wasn't listening to, that was also happening at that moment, that I wasn't ready to take charge on, and I needed to be ready to take charge on. And when I did take charge on those things, the anxiety went like away. But it was a lot of work. And it was a lot of walking right into that fear. But what a beautiful human thing that we have that open to us.
Tony, on my website for the book, I have a workbook for anyone who is questioning whether or not they've been in a high control religion or a cult and how to deal with some of the feelings, sensations in the body. And I work a lot from the toes up. So if anybody's interested in a free workbook, it's available on findingtruthwithmichael.com.
Finding truth with Michael.com. I'm interested. I'm gonna fill that out.
Okay.
Probably not today. I got other
Okay,
things on my mind
good.
today, but in a few weeks I'll tear into that, because
Okay.
the writing is magic. The writing creates magic. I'm just it's it for it connects us. And so thank you so much for writing your memoir to connect even more people. Even if they're not Jehovah's Witnesses, just understand the high control religion. That's not easy. Her name is Darls Santola. The book is called Finding Truth with Michael, a memoir of faith, friendship, faith, and first love. Darls, thanks for coming on the show.
Tony, it was such a delight to sit with you and to visit with you and know you better. Thank you so much.
Darryl Centello on Drinks with Tony. Oh, that was that. As you can tell, we had a lot to talk about. Just a reminder that starting April 6 is my workshop, the Novel Approach Workshop with Tony Duchesne, where we will talk about healing our souls and the joy and the grief of writing a novel, and diving into the magic of what it takes to write a novel, the beauty of it, and also the daily grind. It's time to write your novel. If you've been thinking about it, join me. We have fun. I will see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Everybody wants to go to heaven.
such a thing.
Penny gets you in, but it won't.